Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the May 2009 Home Education Conference held at Southern Virginia University.
The Living History series that I have created and that you're interested in using in your homeschool, I started in 1993 to write them, and we started homeschooling our kids that year, and we found that there was just nothing out there that really provided the kids with the information that they needed when it came to history. And I was a graduate of George Wythe College in 1998, but I had been doing my studies, and I found that it was extremely fascinating to learn history in story form. I also worked for Glenn Kimber at BFA at that particular time in Portland, Oregon. And so I fell in love with the story form method of teaching. And then I also wanted to be able to share that knowledge with my students, both at the private school that I was in and with our kids at home, and put God and religion back into history. So I took a little project to rewrite history in story form and with God and religion back in it. And thus was created Living History. Here's a handout that you'll need for class here. Okay. And so as I began to write my history program, my first thing that I did was I created a master outline, which is what you see on the handout there. And as I began to do my work, I realized that there's no way in the world that I could teach world history or U.S. history in one single year and get everything covered in one year, especially telling it in story form, which would make it much more interesting for the kids. But there's also a lot more information being provided and putting God and religion back into history so that the kids understand why people did what they did. Because our faith in God, or even a lack of faith in God, becomes a motivating factor for most people. And if you take that out of history, then history is nothing. It's just empty shell of stuff and of information. But you put that other stuff back into it, it makes it a very fascinating thing to learn. And so it evolved into what you see there, a six-year history curriculum. And with nine particular volumes. I think there's somebody there at the door. Little kids, I guess. And so the way I have that structured, and the way that I teach it, and the way that my wife taught it with our kids at home, and how I taught it at BFA, was if you look at the world before Christ, there's three volumes. And what I did, let's say that we were just starting a brand new school, this was the first year, so I would start with volume one, of the world before Christ, and it's designed where you would teach each volume for 2 weeks. I mean, each epic for 2 weeks, and there's nine epics to the volume. And so, in volume one, you see that the epic 4000 BC to 2344, the specific stories covered are the atonement, creation of Adam and Eve, Garden of Eden, Tree of Life, and the fall of man. Volume two, same time periods, but you have different information being covered. Volume 3, again, same time period, again, different information being covered. So if a person wanted to cover everything in Epic 1, before they moved on to Epic 2, they would need to purchase all three volumes and teach them across, and so that would take you 6 weeks to cover Epic 1, since it's designed for 2 weeks for each. For me, for my preferences, I'd like to start my school year at the beginning, 4000 BC, and end with current time and current events and events happening today. So what I would do is I would continue on down the epic dates. Let me give you a flyer. And so I'd start out my school year the 1st of September. I'm teaching epic number one. Then mid-September, 2 weeks later, I'm on to epic number two. So that by the time I get down to epic number nine, I'm at mid-January. And so these are the stories that your child would learn using volume number one of World Before Christ. Then if you flip the page over, I would continue on with World After Christ, volume one, epic one. And, of course, I start that series with the life of the Savior anyway. Okay, and so he is our main focus for those next 2 weeks. And then it would continue on 2 weeks for each of those epics until finally by the end of May, you're down to talking about current events, prophecy being fulfilled, and where your children fit into history and what is their role and responsibilities. And so that would be a school year. What age I start these kids, the books are designed for them to read independently at age 12. They don't need mom standing there at the table lecturing them. And I found that when I went to the homeschool conventions, especially the LDS ones, the older kids, they didn't have anything to study from. Most everything that was available back in when we started homeschooling our kids were just for the younger ages. So I purposely wrote for the high school and older age group of kids. They didn't need you. And besides that, I would have my older kids help my wife teach the younger ones. And even at the private school at BFA where I was teaching, I would tell the students in advance, I'm going to be covering such and such an epic on such and such a date. Who would like to teach the lesson? And I would have volunteers, and then I would give them specifically what information they would need to cover for that particular time period, and they become the teachers. And who learns more, the teacher or the student? The teacher always learns more. And so those kids learned an awful lot more of information when they became the teacher to their peers than if they were just sitting there in class listening to me lecture. And it gave my wife a break, and it also gave me a break whenever I was teaching the class. But I would still read the lesson material to make sure that they covered everything that needed to be covered. But it's much more relaxing when you realize that you don't have to teach everything each time. We can reach over there. Okay. So that would be the first school year. Then I like to change subjects, and I would go to United States history. So if you turn the page over again, United States history, there are two volumes. This is a little bit different in that there is just way too much information to cover on U.S. history to spend just 2 weeks on an epic, and so you spend a month. And so in volume one, you're going to spend a month on epic one, a month on two, and so forth, so that you have the 9 months of the school year. So you start with epic one on the 1st of September, and you're going to be at epic nine when you start the month of May. And I have it structured in this particular fashion here. I wanted to tell the story of the founding of the 13 colonies. I didn't want my students just to learn about Jamestown and just to learn about Plymouth, but what happened in South Carolina? How did North Carolina get started? What's the story behind Georgia? And so if you look on Epic 2, Volume 1, I have the founding of the 13 colonies. To do that, I then had to put in Volume 2, Epic 2, Life in Colonial America, because that was a separate story unto itself, to spend a month learning what life was like in Colonial America. So since I wanted to do the founding of the 13 colonies, that then required me in Epic 1 of Volume 1 to establish what brought people over here in the first place. And so there is the Reformation, the political and religious dealings that were going on in Europe, setting the stage for what caused the people to come over here that they would study on the next month. Now you have also going on at the same time during the time you're studying the political and religious changes that are going on in Europe, all of the explorers. They are covered in Volume 2. So basically what would happen is, as I would go on to other volumes, it would become a review to the first volume. And we say, now we learned about this, now we're going to add on this information. So my second year of school would be United States history. Third year would be back to world history. So you go back to the first page, and now we're dealing with Volume 2 of The World Before Christ and Volume 2 of The World After Christ for the third school year. Here's a handout for you. And then the fourth school year would be Volume 2 of United States history. Fifth school year would be Volume 3 of ancient history. Or World Before Christ and World After Christ. Okay, so the first volume, The World Before and The World After, is the first school year. Then Volume 1 of United States History is the second school year. Right? Then Volume 2 of World Before and World After is third school year. And then Volume 2 of United States History is the fourth school year. Volume 3, World Before and World After, is the fifth year. And then Native American History is the sixth year. Now, as I mentioned earlier before the rest of you walked in here, if you wanted to cover everything that there was in ancient world history before you went on to modern world history, you would need to purchase all three volumes of ancient world history, World Before Christ, and it would take you a year and a half because each volume is designed for a half a school year's worth of study. And I do have those who use my history program and say, I want to cover everything first. But what that does, though, is it limits you that you cannot be talking about current events until 3 years from the time you start talking about world history. Me, personally, the Lord's doing too much. There's too much going on to wait that long before I can talk about current events. I don't know if you imagine what's going on in the world today and just think you can't talk about this for 3 years until you get to the end. There's way too much going on. Okay. Same with United States history. I can't spend 2 years of teaching United States history before I finally get down to current events. So that's why I do a year. And also, I alternate the topics so that the kids don't get bored with just world history or just U.S. history. I alternate it back and forth. So then as I progress to other volumes, I then say, now if you remember, we talked about this and this and this in Volume 1. Now we're going to add on this, and then I would go on with the current information. That's what this flyer is all about here that I've given to you, how I've broken it down and the reasoning behind what I've done. I might mention, if you look at Native American history on the back there, it does include Book of Mormon. What I've done is I've divided it up, the topic up into North, Central, and South America, following the cultures in that particular order. You see the culture groups that are discussed under each epic under North, Central, or South America. And the first three epics involve Book of Mormon studies also. That fits along with the same time period. A change happens in Native American history when you get to Epic 6. After the Spanish come, they obliterate the Native Americans in Central and South America. And so they are no longer able to be studied as a culture group because there are so few of them. And they are just interspersed amongst the Spanish society. And so at that point in Epic 6, Central and South America become a study of the countries. Whereas North America, the Native American groups remained intact, and so we're able to study them by their culture. And then at the end, in Epic number 9 in Central and South America, a lot of the Native Americans are now beginning to come into their own. Their populations are increasing to where they are now becoming usually a significant minority in their countries. And then I include a history on them. And just for fun, I also give you an idea of how the church's growth has happened in the last 4 years by how many members there are, temples, districts, and stakes, and so forth. Well, I have up here at the table the textbooks. They're all designed with comb binding so that the book lays open for you. Whenever I have quoted somebody, I've always indented and italicized so that you would know what the quote is versus what I am talking about here. At the beginning of each epic in each volume, they are all structured the same. If I can find the beginning here, I'll show you. So here would be the beginning of an epic. This is 2344 to 1900. So this would be epic number 2, volume 3 of World Before Christ. Then what I have done up here at the top, if you see, if you go across volume 1, 2, and 3 for epic number 2, you'll see all the topics that are going to be studied during that time period in this series. I have them all listed right here. Then I take all of these stories, which are in all three volumes, for you to be able to see real in a condensed version, and put them on a timeline, the next page over, and then use an asterisk to let you know which volume it's covered in. So that you as a teacher can see real quick, you know, which volume you'll be covering the Jaredites, where you'll be covering the land of Egypt, the land of Canaan, and so forth. So that you can kind of get an advanced knowledge and idea of what's going on. There are those who like to make sure I wrote everything correctly. And so I have my bibliography, my list of sources are all listed right here. Then suggested videos that I've seen that I could recommend for that particular time period for these subjects being studied. And then suggested literature is here. It goes along with this time period. Now, one project that my wife and I are involved in right now is as soon as our Wholesome Books website gets up and running the way we want it to be, which is all our big bookstore out here, we are then going to link all the books to my history books so that you could have a suggested literature reading program based per epic and per volume. And then you would just click on the book title and it'll take you right over to the Wholesome Books website and you can read a detail about what that book covers. And so I've got a lot of people that like to include, and we like to do the same thing, include a literature program to go along with history. Quite often, well, what do I have my kids study in literature? Well, why not something that's historical that goes with the time period? And most people don't know necessarily where all of the books fit in time, and so my wife and I are doing that. Here's your handout if you'd like one, ma'am. Okay. So that gives you a brief history and creation of how I did this. I published my first book in 1999. When I graduated from George Wythe in 1998, we all had to give a acceptance speech with our degree. That's what Oliver wanted us to tell you. What are you going to do with your degree now? And Cleon Skousen was in the audience, and a couple other heavyweights were there in the audience. That was kind of intimidating to be speaking to those kind of people. And I was telling about my program because I was a year away from publishing the very first one, World Before Christ, Volume 1. And so I was telling about my program and some of the stories that I had produced and all that. And Oliver DeMille came up afterwards and he said, send me a copy of your manuscript on your first volume. And if I like it, and if you don't mind, I'll send you the foreword that I'd like you to put in each of the books. And about 3 weeks later, I got a foreword from him. And so now the foreword is in the front of each volume. And he considers these some of the classics that he's always talked about, classics. And his definition of a classic is a book in which you can return back to time and time again to learn stuff. And one of the things that he mentions about classics I guess I don't have it on this one. I thought I had it in here. But anyway, it's important for our kids to understand the purpose of history and the lessons that are there for us to learn. Part of the problems that we have with our country today is we have not learned the lessons. We're repeating the same mistakes that we've done in the past, and we will continue to have the same results. Man thinks that he can outsmart God and can outsmart the past by either spending more money or we're smarter today than they were back then, and we've got a better way of doing it. We're creating the same stuff over and over again. You guys, as parents of your kids, have a wonderful opportunity to teach them truth and help them understand where God fits in history and where religion fits in history and why people did what they did and how history is his story. It's God's dealings with man and man's dealings with each other. And it all ties together with the life of the Savior. And the sooner we can teach our kids how that works, and the sooner we as parents can learn how that works, the more knowledgeable your children will become when it comes to history. And then history will be something that's very fun. One of the things that I enjoyed the most was when the light bulb would turn on in the eyes of my students that would be sitting in class. And I had 60 kids in the morning and I had 60 kids in the afternoon. And as I would teach them the stories of history, that would begin to touch their spirit, and we would have, you'd hear ahas, and you'd see little light bulbs turn on and their facial expressions change. And it would be fascinating that I would have the next day, I would give them a challenge. Instead of giving them a test, I would say, for the next 10 minutes, I want you to recall everything that you can think of that we talked about in history the day before. And I would either do that in bullet point format. In other words, I just want facts, as many facts as you can write down. Other days, I would, I remember one time I had them write a letter to one of the founding fathers after we had finished our discussion of the Constitution and the Declaration. I says, pick one of your favorite founding fathers and write him a letter of thank you. That particular assignment, I did not have my students turn in to me. I says, you keep that. That goes into your history notebook. Other students, other assignments that I would give them, especially the bullet point ones, I would tell them, I want you to turn this in, because that gave me an idea to see what they were recalling from the day before. Sometimes I'd even give them an assignment from the week before, recall whatever it was that we talked about. At the beginning of the school year, it was a little bit hard for them to do. They weren't used to that kind of an exercise. By the end of the school year, 10 minutes was never enough time for them to be able to do it. And it was fun to watch them evolve and be able to learn how to recall history facts through the Spirit. As the room would quiet down and the kids would tune into the Spirit, the promise is that He would teach you all truth. And since history is His story, the Spirit will bring back to your remembrance that which you have learned. And we would go through this exercise every day until the kids learned how to identify when the Spirit was talking to them, and then they couldn't write fast enough. And it was fun to watch that happen as the school year would go by. One of the advantages of teaching history as a story is to help the kids understand why certain things happened, why it's important to remember an event, or why it's important to remember a date. And I remember one story that I have in my United States history book is about the Erie Canal. And I remember when I was going to write about the Erie Canal, I thought the only thing I remember from school about the Erie Canal is it was completed in 1825. And I thought, so what? Who cares? All it was a big ditch that they dug. And it was finished in 1825. As I began to study and write the story, it became very fascinating to me why the Erie Canal is such a critical thing to remember. It breached the Appalachian Mountains. Up until that point, all we had to get over the Appalachians were Indian trails and old cart trails to get over across the mountain. Well, when the people, you know, it doesn't work to get across that way. We didn't have the train. It hadn't been started yet. Of course, they didn't have cars and anything else. But when all of a sudden they could float down a canal hundreds of miles and get across and connect to the Lake Erie and then use those lakes to get onto the Ohio and the Mississippi and all those rivers, now all of a sudden the West, as it was called then, opened up for exploration. And then what the farmers had grown and created back west, they could then float the other direction on the Erie Canal and have it processed in the east and to be able to receive money for the product that they were creating in the west. So all of a sudden the Erie Canal became critical. And it opened up the whole United States to westward expansion. And of course, 6 years after the canal's completed, then the church is established in Kirtland on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains. If you notice that the church's history is all on this side of the mountains until after 1830 and the Erie Canal being completed, then all of a sudden the saints go across and start preaching over there and Kirtland, Ohio gets started. Okay? But anyway, some of the interesting tidbits about the Erie Canal that I found out was there was a speed limit on the Erie Canal of 4 miles an hour. And the reason why they limited it to 4 miles an hour is they found that if the canal boat owners had their horses pull the canal boat, because remember, we didn't have the motor yet, pulled their canal boat along the towpath, it was along the edge, faster than 4 miles an hour, the wake from the boat would wash against the shore and dig away at the shoreline. And then that would collapse. And, of course, you got the towpath right there, right next to it, that the horses were following, so the towpath would disintegrate. And all the businesses whose businesses were established right along the canal, they'd all fall into the canal. So they put up a speed limit of 4 miles an hour. Well, the canal boat owners realized that if they paid the fine of $10 for speeding on the Erie Canal, they could still make more money by transporting things back and forth at that 6 to 7 mile an hour speed and make up by far more than what they had spent for the $10. Now, the way the Erie Canal was structured was the canal bridges that went over the canal were set very low. It was a lot cheaper to build. Remember, they were just trying to build this thing so that they could get going. And there was only 5 or 6 foot clearance between the top of the river and the bottom of the canal. The canal boat owner would just hop onto the bridge and run over and pay the fee and hop back onto his boat as it's going back on the other side of the bridge. Those people who would like to just take a stroll along the path, Yeah, you can easily, you know, walk at a good clip going along there and take a stroll along the towpath and then get back onto your boat when you got tired of walking. You could spend time up on the top of the canal boat, sunning yourself or just enjoying the scenery going by at four miles an hour. But there was a song created about the low bridge. And the steersman in the back, when they approached the low bridge, you know, he'd yell out, "Low bridge ahead, everybody down." And if you didn't duck down or drop down onto the deck, you'd be knocked off into the canal or knocked down to the deck of the canal boat and have some serious injury. And so it created the song, low bridge ahead, everybody down. Anyway, that's an interesting song. Inside the canal boat, it was a place for the people to mill around. To, you know, if it was raining or bad weather, they could be inside. Or if they were tired of the sun, they could be inside. And all the beds were hoisted up against the walls. And then at nighttime, they would drop down by chains, and you'd have three deckers of bread, three levels of beds. And they were so narrow that you just kind of slide in sideways into your bed, and you're just there. Because the canal, it's only about 5 feet high, was the canal boat. And they just have enough room in there to debunk people. And so here you are, just kind of hemmed in, just trying to while the night away until it was time for the next day to go to wake up and carry on your day. There was a German immigrant by the name of Frederick Gerstaker. And I found this story, and I remember it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and I busted a gut laughing when I read this, and I thought, I've got to include this story, and so I wanted to share this story with you. And this is now what helps me remember the Erie Canal and why it was so important. Frederick, he writes, "I awoke with a dreadful feeling of suffocation. Cold perspiration stood on my forehead, and I could hardly draw my breath. There was a weight like lead on my stomach and chest. I attempted to cry out in vain. I lay almost without consciousness. The weight remained immovable. Above me was a noise like distant thunder. It was my companion in the upper story who lay snoring over my head, and that the weight which pressed upon my chest was caused by his body no longer remained a doubtful point. I endeavored to move the colossus. Impossible. I tried to push, to cry out, in vain. He lay like a rock on my chest and seemed to have no more feeling." In his plight, Gerstaker just managed to reach his neckerchief scarf pin and jab sharply right where the weight was heaviest. There was a cry of, "What's that? Murder! Help!" from above. Then the weight was momentarily lifted and Gerstaker slid out and stood on the floor. In the dim lamplight, he discovered that the worn canvas of the bunk above had ripped under the weight of his fat neighbor, and that the man, in effect, had been sitting on Gerstaker's chest. The pin thrust had caused the man to jerk upward, allowing Gerstaker to escape. But now the canvas had split even more, so that the unfortunate man was sitting on the bunk below with his head and feet still out, still in his own, crying half asleep, "Help, murder." Anyway, I thought that was my, and I'd read that story, and the kids, they go to BYU or the University of Utah or something, and I just live in Heber City, and I quite often get an email from, "I still remember the Gerstaker story." Anyway, but those are when the kids remember stuff, and my books are just filled with doing that, to help kids understand. Yes. But you're going to follow all history, okay? You've got history on everything, okay? And when there are stories that go along with it, then I include the story. But there are also the facts and the figures that of events happening. Like we go through, say, Alexander the Great, and we're following all of his exploits and stuff. But there are various, he was a brilliant military general and strategist. Napoleon followed Alexander the Great and Caesar when he did his exploits in France and Europe. Because of the great strategy that those two greats did. And I tell some of their stories about their battles, especially when Alexander the Great tries to take Tyre and what he went through for 7 months to try and conquer the little part of the city that was out in the Mediterranean Sea. And then how he ended up becoming considered the son of Zeus and how he was worshipped as the god of the Greek Empire. And just all the various stories. But I also go through a chronological order. But so that the person doesn't get bogged down with the facts and figures, you include the stories that go along with it. Now, our time is wrapped up, but is gone. your kids need to create what's called a history notebook. And in this history notebook, this is theirs. Whenever they want to, they create a cover for whatever is important for them. This is one of my kids' cover of ancient world or the modern world history. This is his cover on United States history. But in here, you would take a tab and have, for whichever volume it is, or whichever series it is, the world before Christ, world after Christ, or United States history. They would create a tab, and then behind this tab is all of their notes, and all of their map work, and all of their timeline work, and any book reports that you've had them do. They then create a history notebook of their work behind that particular time period. And then when you're done with that, you go to the next time period. And so obviously here's his map of colonial America. I provide a lot of maps in the back of my textbooks. You can make copies and the kids then create their own. Don't you just make a copy of a map and say, here, put it in your history notebook. No, part of learning is the eye-hand coordination, the coloring and all that, where they create their own map. You've got a master to help them create their own. They create their own timelines. You give them handouts if need be for whatever you want them to have. This is an essay that one of my kids had done. It's a picture that we had found. Another essay of another key individual for this particular one. I've just shown different examples for you. And then your timelines, they can be real elaborate or they can be real simple. You just got your numbers and dates and so forth. You can add pictures. You can make on your timeline to include mathematicians, authors, all that kind of stuff, okay? Can all be part of the history notebook. But this becomes theirs. Yes?
Are those assignments in the book?
These are just ones that you would create. Okay. Now, I do have a handout where how to teach living history. Those who use my history set, something that my wife put together, I give to them as a copy. It's got some suggestions on how to do the history notebook and so forth. So, any questions besides that? Because I guess our time is up.
What makes your curriculum different than others?
Depends on who the others are. When I used to teach for Glenn Kimber, he had a particular focus on things that he wanted to cover. And Hitch was a very religious thing that he followed, the religious activities that were going on. When I taught his history program, because I was with BFA for 5 years with him, I wanted to teach other things also. I wanted my history program to be all-inclusive, and so that's what I've done of the whole world. Not just specific things, but everything that goes on, whether it's ancient or modern history or U.S. history or whatever. I wanted my students to have an education on all of it.
How does it compare with something like a story of the world or other
story that you're going to get an LDS perspective from mine, where with that one you will not. I bring in other information that we've learned from either from revelations or additional information from the prophets, and include that in my history. Okay. Yeah.
The ages are
12 and up,
okay,
for reading by themselves.
Right.
Other than that, you need to read it and then share it to them.
So is there a minimum age at which you think you could use it?
Oh, about 12 that they can read on their own. But if you wanted to
have elementary age?
Oh, if they can handle the level, you can read it. I've got it at my booth. You can come over here and take a look at it and see if it's something that your child could handle. My time is up. Thank you.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.